from Washington. This is VOA's International Edition. Coming up, the U.S. deploys troops to Iraq to secure American interests. The Iraq crisis poses a threat to the global oil market.
Any additional increment of another outage would just raise prices as they already did in the last couple of days.
WHO says the situation regarding MERS remains serious. And the Cousteau Society expresses support for Obama's marine protection proposal. It's all ahead. I'm Susan Yawkey. U.S. President Barack Obama has notified Congress he may deploy as many as 275 troops to Iraq to secure American interests as the Iraqi government struggles to contain Islamist insurgents. VOA White House correspondent Luis Ramirez reports.
President Obama said the force of up to 275 troops has begun arriving to provide support and security for American personnel and the U.S. Embassy in Baghdad. On Friday, the president said he would not be sending U.S. troops back into combat in Iraq, but in his letter to Congress Monday, he indicated the troops going to Iraq now are armed and ready to fight if necessary. Mr. Obama met with his national security team on Monday after returning from a weekend in California. Advisors have been working to present him with a list of options to deal with the Sunni insurgency, which has taken over much of Iraq and is threatening Baghdad. Iran, an unlikely U.S. partner, also has expressed concern about the violence in Iraq. In an unusual move Monday, U.S. officials spoke with the Iranians about possible cooperation on the sidelines of nuclear talks in Vienna. On Mr. Obama's flight back to Washington, White House spokesman Josh Earnest ruled out any discussion of military cooperation with Iran.
In any conversations with the Iranian regime will not include military coordination. We're not interested in any effort to coordinate military activities with Iran.
U.S. officials say 170 troops already are in Iraq, and about 100 more could be deployed as needed. Officials say the soldiers are entering Iraq with the consent of the Iraqi government and will help relocate some staff from the U.S. Embassy in Baghdad. The embassy itself remains open. The U.S. administration on Monday sought to reassure Americans that the deployment is not another open-ended commitment of troops to Iraq. In his letter to Congress, President Obama said the force would remain in Iraq until the security situation becomes such that it is no longer needed. Luis Ramirez, VOA News, at the White House.
The crisis in Iraq is threatening the oil industry in the region. Jamie Webster, senior director at IHS Energy, and his colleagues have written a commentary on the issue. We asked him how the conflict is affecting oil production.
So right now we're not seeing any actual impact on oil production. What we're doing is what this has done is kind of changed the sentiment for oil markets. Because right now we are looking at a period of time where oil markets actually have around 3 to 3.5 million barrels a day that are offline out of the market right now. And so any additional increment of another outage would just raise prices as they already did in the last couple of days quite a bit more, particularly as Iraq is viewed as really one of the key kind of suppliers, particularly for the Middle East, over the next couple of years. So if you're just suddenly talking about, you know, moving away from growth and actually going into something where it's shrinking, it's really very nervous for markets. But so far, we haven't had anything. What has happened instead is that there's one pipeline that has actually been offline since March, the Kirkuk-Ceyhan pipeline. And that pipeline is now not going to be able to be rehabilitated at least anytime soon as far as we can tell. So that is one production that is not expected to come back. But again, that has already been offline since March.
And that's in the northern part of the country where most of this fighting has taken place.
That is correct. And actually, the reason why that pipeline has needed to be repaired is because this same group has actually been perpetuating these attacks over the last couple of years, off and on that and other energy infrastructure up there.
Well, what options do we have in the future to control the prices if this crisis in Iraq does continue and becomes worse?
Controlling the prices in terms of oil prices is out of, I would say it's pretty much out of anyone's hands to truly control it. It can be kind of bent in one way or the other. We've got a pretty kind of potential for a pretty tight market, which for your listeners means higher oil prices this summer. And the reason for that is because you've got all of these outages that have occurred, Saudi Arabia has had to increase its production quite a bit. And this increased production has actually reduced its spare capacity. So as it produces more, it has less kind of spare capacity, because that is where the world kind of gets, is where we get our kind of shock absorber for the oil market, where if we need more oil, we just always go to Saudi Arabia. But at a certain point, Saudi Arabia doesn't have a whole lot more spare capacity. And this summer, their production might rise to, 10.5 million barrels a day. Their max productive capacity is around 12.5. And that's not a whole lot for the world to feel comfortable.
Is this all part of releasing oil from the strategic reserves, as it's called?
That's one option that I think is on the table right now. It hasn't been talked about just yet too terribly much, but I guarantee that is being looked at right now. So the Strategic Petroleum Reserves in the United States and other IEA countries, that is one option to be able to try to loosen up the markets a little bit. The last time they tried to do that, when Libya went offline, it was actually very successful in the U.S., but not so successful in Europe and other parts of the world. So I think there's going to be a little bit of hesitance to take any volumes out of the Strategic Petroleum Reserves as kind of a broad EIA sort of move. It is always possible that the U.S. could end up deciding to push out some oil, particularly as we've got it in our Strategic Petroleum Reserves much more than we actually need, precisely because we are, one of the biggest growers of production in the world and have been for the last couple of years.
Jamie Webster, Senior Director at IHS Energy. U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry says the United States is prepared to engage with longtime foe Iran as part of a strategy to blunt the advance of the Sunni militant group known as the Islamic State of Iraq and the Levant. VOA's Victor Beatty has more on the story.
In an interview with Yahoo News, Kerry said the Obama administration is open to discussions with Iran if there's something constructive that it can contribute.
If Iran is prepared to do something that is going to respect the integrity and sovereignty of Iraq and the ability of the government to reform. At this moment, I think we need to go step by step and see what, in fact, might be a reality. But I wouldn't rule out anything that would be constructive to providing real stability, a respect for the Constitution, a respect for the election process, and a respect for the ability of the Iraqi people to form a government that represents all of the interests of Iraq. Not one sectarian group over another. It has to be inclusive, and that has been one of the great problems of the last few years.
Kerry says Washington is open to any constructive process that minimizes violence, holds Iraq together, and eliminates the presence of outside terrorist forces that are ripping it apart. But he says there is a larger reason to hold ISIL's growing presence in Iraq.
They clearly are focused not just there, but they're focused on trying to do harm to Europe, to America, and other people. And that's why we believe it is so important for us to be engaged and to be leading an effort to try to deal with this, and that's exactly what we're doing.
Greg Barton, who co-directs the Center for Islam in the Modern World at Australia's Monash University, says U.S.-Iranian consultations would be significant, suggesting Iran prefers to see a stable Iraq under friendly Shia Prime Minister Nouri al-Maliki to an unstable and hostile Sunni jihadist movement in Iraq that poses a threat to its own security.
Perhaps they can help work with Americans and others in getting the Maliki government to recognize that the solution to what's happening is as much a political solution as it is a military solution. The reason that ISIL has taken so much territory is because local populations are so jaundiced towards Baghdad. And if Baghdad can work in building confidence first with the Kurds in the northeast and then with the Sunnis in the Sunni triangle to the northwest of Baghdad, they have half a chance of using these tendencies of ISIL to outstay its welcome through its draconian moral policing to use that to their advantage and begin to reclaim towns and cities, perhaps eventually getting Mosul back.
Barton says ISIL's goal is not marching onto Baghdad, but establishing an Islamic caliphate encompassing eastern Syria and north-central Iraq. He says they've nearly achieved that, but whether they can keep the territory captured remains an open question. The brutal occupation, he says, could turn the Sunni population against them. Al Jazeera reports the source of ISIL's funding and power remains unclear, Barton says state funding is complicated to prove, but private giving is not.
There's a lot of private donations coming out of Saudi Arabia and Qatar and Kuwait and the other Gulf states. In more recent times, it now has its own source of funding. Controlling oil fields, gas fields in the east of Syria gives it a revenue stream. And now, having overrun Mosul, it acquired a large amount of cash and gold bullion and military hardware in overrunning Mosul and in the other towns that it's occupied. So it probably is sitting pretty as far as financial resources and military hardware goes. The key thing is whether it can hold the social capital that it currently enjoys with the support of Sunnis in the north of Iraq and the east of Syria.
U.S. State Department spokeswoman Jennifer Psaki on Monday acknowledged that money and assistance are flowing to ISIL from Syria, and it's a matter the U.S. is raising with Iraq's Sunni neighbors. Victor Beatty, VOA News, Washington.
Britain plans to reopen its embassy in Iran 2.5 years after protesters angry at new British sanctions stormed and ransacked the site in Tehran. Foreign Secretary William Hague said in a written statement to Parliament today that some practical issues need to be resolved, but the circumstances are right to reopen the embassy. He said once arrangements are made, the embassy will have a small initial presence. Britain closed the embassy in late 2011 and expelled Iran's diplomats from their embassy in London. The two countries later reestablished diplomatic ties, and Iran partially reopened its embassy in February to provide consular services. Looking for more than just headlines? Then listen to International Edition. We'll deliver in-depth news reporting, background investigations, and experts on the day's top news.
It's become a highly polarized situation in Egypt, and the government has put Egyptians under strong pressure to choose a side.
I can't imagine the pain and the sorrow and the emptiness that I've caused you and your family.
The report exposes brutality that stands in stark contrast to our values as a nation.
I'm International Edition host and producer Susan Yawkey, inviting you to tune in for our half hour of the latest world news on the radio or on the programs tab at voanews.com. The World Health Organization says the situation regarding Middle East Respiratory Syndrome, or MERS, remains serious, but it will not declare a public health emergency at this time. The WHO says, however, the disease is of concern because of anticipated travel later this year for Ramadan and the Hajj. VOA's Joe DiCapua reports.
There have been more than 700 confirmed cases of MERS and about 250 deaths. The WHO Emergency Committee, set up to monitor the outbreak, says the upsurge in cases seen in April has significantly decreased. It adds that significant efforts to improve infection prevention and control were being undertaken in the Middle East. What's more, there is still no evidence of person-to-person transmission in communities. Dr. Keiji Fukuda is the WHO's Assistant Director General for Health Security.
On the basis of those lines of information, the Emergency Committee assessed that the current situation does not constitute a public health emergency of international concern.
It's suspected the coronavirus that causes MERS is transmitted from camels to humans. However, no one knows yet how that might happen. But there's also a risk of infection at health facilities when precautions are not taken.
Our current understanding is that the upsurge in cases is primarily related to transmission occurring in hospitals, in essence, primarily related to suboptimal infection prevention and control measures. So many of the cases that were thought to have occurred in the community are really related to infections occurring in hospitals.
Fukuda says the hospital outbreaks will be studied further.
Patients often meet before they have a diagnosis in crowded areas such as emergency rooms and emergency departments. And what exactly is the breakdown in infection and prevention control measures there?
The WHO Emergency Committee continues to advise countries to strengthen efforts to implement basic infection prevention and control measures and increase education about MERS for healthcare workers. It also says critical investigations regarding case control, as well as blood, environmental, and animal studies, should be completed as soon as possible. Dr. Fukuda says the WHO is calling on vulnerable countries, especially those in Africa, to be prepared for MERS cases later this year.
In the African countries, we have two important conditions. One of them is that there are a sizable number of people who travel every year to Saudi Arabia and to the Middle East as part of pilgrimages and then as part of other reasons for traveling. And secondly, in the African countries, there are some basic capacities which remain limited. And so some of these basic capacities are things such as surveillance, and in the healthcare facilities, standards for infection prevention and control can often be suboptimal.
Fukuda says it's also important to raise awareness among pilgrims about Middle East respiratory syndrome and the importance of personal hygiene when traveling. Saudi Arabia is also reported to be stepping up surveillance and prevention measures in anticipation of the Hajj. Fukuda says it will take a significant amount of work to determine just how the virus may be transmitted from camels to humans.
For example, is it because camels sneeze? Is it because that there may be a contamination of virus in things such as milk products? Even if we find virus in these things, it still doesn't tell us exactly that this is how people are getting infected.
He says what seems like a simple question to answer requires many studies. Joe DiCapua, VOA News, Washington.
U.S. President Barack Obama is planning to create the world's largest marine preserve, significantly expanding a remote region of the Pacific Ocean where drilling, fishing, and other commercial activities are prohibited. The White House said today the president is seeking to protect waters in the South Central Pacific between the island state of Hawaii and the U.S. territory of American Samoa. Officials say the exact boundaries of the preserve have not been set, but that Mr. Obama could expand the protected area already in place from 225,000 square kilometers to more than 2 million. The waters are adjacent to seven islands and atolls controlled by the U.S. White House officials said the region includes some of the most pristine tropical marine environments in the world, but warned they are vulnerable because of the impact of climate change and ocean acidification. For reaction to the announcement, we spoke with Francine Cousteau, president of the Cousteau Society.
It's a declaration that is very important because any initiative to protect the ocean is something really good. And we can only encourage people to do anything possible to encourage the protection of the ocean. On the other hand, I would say it's the beginning of a long story, because it means that we need new laws for this protection, to guarantee this protection. We need certainly international agreement between all countries using this huge space to apply the laws. It means we will need means to detect, to arrest, to punish by all the people who would bypass the law, which means also we will have to have a specialized organism to survey the place by satellite, boats, planes, and also the means for immediate intervention. It means we will need an international court for the ocean and lawyers, judges, to be able to deliver judgment and punishment to the people who will bypass the law. And my question is, if all this has to be done, it has to be done for the entire ocean. So the solution is great to start with an American possibility to protect a larger area of the ocean, but it's going to take a long, long time before we have the budget and the means to do all that. So why not to do it internationally instead of doing it for only one country? I think the ocean globally needs protection, and we little by little must find the means to guarantee this protection with all the example I have taken before, between the laws, the court, the means of survey, the organism. It's certainly going to take a long time to put all that in place, but let us hope that the initiative of the president will bring to some solution in the future.
Do you think the United Nations should step in here and take this project up?
I think we still have to think about that, because even if the United Nations are very important, as it's the only organism we have which represents all the countries, And certainly we must try very hard to improve it, and to the point that one day it will have the necessary power to take decisions. Today, my fear is that, yes, for the global protection of the ocean, there are already some organisms who do that. But we should look further. And my concept is that it's not enough to speak about countries being represented at the UN. It's to speak about the continents to be represented. Because in North America, you are lucky. You have basically only two countries between Canada and the United States, which hold most of the coast bordering the oceans. But in some part of the world, it's divided in so many countries that it looks like impossible to have everybody agreeing. Or what I would say is that the oceans are a common wealth. And these common wealth should be protected by every continent which is next to it, and not by the countries themselves. We have to go further in the way to manage the future, because we have so many countries today, and everybody has so diverse interests. I believe that the only way to really be efficient would be to have representative of continents, one for North America, one for South America, and every continent like that. We would focus on this common wealth, on this common treasure, even if we don't agree on other things. Countries are not obliged to agree on everything, but at least to protect what we have in common, and that could not be replaced, and that is so important for life, they should agree to have these kind of thoughts.
Now, as you admit, this is a very, very big issue. Do you have any optimism that it can be accomplished?
Oh, yes, because we have to start with something. And that's the reason I think that the initiative is good, is because it should not leave people imagine that it is going to solve everything in 2 days. But it should be encouraged because it's the beginning of something that is a must for the future. So, yes, it's a good initiative, and it has to be encouraged and helped in order to go to its full success in how many years, I don't know, but that is the good road.
Francine Cousteau, president of the Cousteau Society and widow of Jacques Cousteau. The protected ocean area Mr. Obama wants to expand was first designated a U.S. Marine Monument by his predecessor, President George W. Bush.
Put your flags up in the sky. Hi, this is Sonny Young of the Sunny Side of Sports. Visit VOAfootball.com for live updates on the World Cup in Brazil. The site is optimized for your mobile phone or tablet and will bring you the latest scores, stats, photos, and videos. And everything can be shared with your friends from your mobile device to Facebook and Twitter. World Cup nonstop at VOAfootball.com.
In World Cup action, the United States took a 2-1 win over Ghana in a Group G match. It was a surprise win.
It was amazing. USA. USA!
That was amazing. That goal at the end was awesome. It just blew my mind. It was awesome. So good.
Go America!
America!
USA! 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 USA!
Eric Matty and his friends were at the game.
Hey, Ghana played really well. Hands up to the Ghanaians.
They played really well.
Fantastic technical football. We're just happy to scrap out that last goal.
Right.
The early goal.
We'll take the win. USA! USA!
Earlier Monday in the other Group G match, second-ranked Germany trounced fourth-ranked Portugal 4-0. The only other match Monday was a Group F contest that resulted in a scoreless tie between Iran and Nigeria. Thank you for joining us today for International Edition. You can get the latest breaking news and analysis on global events 24 hours a day on our website at voanews.com. I'm Susan Yockey in Washington.